Welcome to New World Notes. Your host this week is Kenneth Doust, sort of like the last 222 weeks. This week, we return to a great talk by Michael Pollan. Last week, he showed that and why our centralized, globalized, corporate-controlled agribusiness system is not only bad, but unsustainable. And he showed that centralized, globalized, corporate-controlled organic agribusiness is not a good alternative. This week, he tells us a story of organic done right on Joel Salatin's farm in Virginia, Polyface Farms. Salatin puts farm animals, farm crops, and soil into a beautiful system of mutual aid. It's a fine and sometimes funny story. But is this a viable alternative to industrial agribusiness? Probably so, Pollan thinks. And he goes on to discuss why farming must be relocalized. Speaking in Davis, California, here again is Michael Pollan.
So after my kind of exploration of industrial organic, as I was forced to call it, I went looking for something more sustainable. And I found something really interesting, and I want to describe a farm that I spent a little time at to you, because I think we need to be cheered up. And because models are very important. We need good models. And you can ask me whether this farm can be scaled up, and you can ask me whether it works in California, and those are all absolutely legitimate questions. But the fact that it exists, I think, can help us define what we mean by this word sustainable. The farm, and if you've read the book, you know a fair amount about it, although I want to stress some other things about it, is Joel Salatin's Polyface Farm in the Shenandoah Valley of Virginia. I found it because I was looking for somebody who would give me, when I was writing about industrial organics, somebody who would give me some really salty quotes about the organic empire. And I had heard that Joel Salatin was that person, that he was a very strident critic of organic today. And I called him up, and I got all my quotes, and he just was fierce in his condemnation of Whole Foods and the organic empire. And I also thought, I'd heard that he grew these amazing pasture chickens, and I was hoping at the end of this conversation that I could get him to send me one. And I was writing an article at the time about organics for the New York Times, and usually if you ask somebody, you know, they'll send you a review steak or a review chicken. And so at the end of my conversation, after I collected all my salty quotes, I said to Joel, I hear you grow these amazing chickens. I'm wondering if you could ship me one. And he said, sorry, I can't do that. And I figured he wasn't set up for shipping. And I said, well, I can send the FedEx guy, and he can come with a styrofoam box. And you know, all you have to do is drop it in, and I'll send you a check. And he said, no, you don't get it. I don't believe it's organic, sustainable, if you will, to FedEx meat across the country. It's like, wow, it was one of my more embarrassing moments as a journalist. I just asked this guy, this avatar of local food, to send me a chicken by FedEx. So he said basically if I wanted to try his chicken, I had to come down to Swope, where he lived, and pick it up myself, which I subsequently did. I learned more about his farm and decided I wanted to spend a week working there. And I kind of had what my wife calls my Paris Hilton adventure. Where I went to work for Joel as a farmhand and worked as hard as I've worked in my life and harder than anything else I did for this book, because I happened to go the week of the summer solstice, which, you know, has got really long days, and it's not when you want to be on a farm. And we were getting up at 5 o'clock, and Joel is, I need to tell you, he describes himself as evangelical Christian conservative environmentalist lunatic farmer. And part of the evangelical part is there's like no caffeine and no alcohol on this farm. So it was a really long week. I was sleeping in a trailer, in his mother's trailer. She lives on the property, in one of these scaled-down trailer rooms where everything is, you know, kind of scaled down, including the bed. And the bed was like 5 feet long, and I'm a little over 6 feet. And so it was a very long week. But I learned a lot, and I saw something as thrilling as anything I've seen in all my years writing about nature and all my years writing about our relationship to the natural world. And I won't go into great detail, and if you want to read more, there's more in the book, or I can take your questions later. But just to summarize, this farm, it's a polyculture, as his name suggests. He has 100 acres of grass, and he grows beef, pork, broilers, eggs, turkey, rabbits. And he's got about six species, and they grow in this very intricate symbiotic system, such that every animal is contributing some ecosystem service to another. 100 acres of grass, 400 acres of woodlot, very hilly land, not very good for row crops, but very good for grass. And if you ask, one of the first questions I asked Joel, I said, what kind of farmer are you? Are you a rancher? Are you a chicken farmer? Are you an egg farmer? And he said, and I'd never heard this before, he said, no, I'm a grass farmer. And that was very striking to me because we don't eat grass. There's no market in grass. You know, there's a little market in hay. How could you be a grass farmer? And he explained to me, well, that's the basis of this ecosystem that he'd created. And he's modeling these relationships on nature, on the relationships of animals and nature. So just to give you one example, and there are several of these, and they're all kind of wonderful, but the relationship of his beef and his chickens, his laying hens. He does grass-fed beef, and he's got a herd, 75 animals or so, and they spend one day in a paddock, and they graze it really completely, okay? When you put that many animals in a quarter acre, that's roughly what they are. They graze it all down completely. And then at the end of the day, he moves them to another paddock. And what allows this to happen is this cheap electric fencing, which is really the enabling, I think, the most important sustainable agriculture technology for animal agriculture is this very light, cheap. I could carry a quarter acre paddock on my shoulder and set it up myself in 10 minutes. It's really remarkable stuff, and it's fairly new. So they would graze down that pasture, and we would build another one right next to it, and he would then open the door. And, you know, you hear about moving the cattle, and you need dogs, and you need a can of chewing tobacco, and you need a lot of trucks, and a lot of screaming, and it wasn't like that at all. They knew the drill. They did it every day, and he kind of opened. He acted more less like a cowboy than a maitre d'. He just kind of opened the door, and the cattle moved from one to another. And they were so happy to get to the next pasture because there was all that fresh, green grass. And the end of the day is when it's sweetest because it's been collecting sugar all during the day. And there's that wonderful, contented sound of cows ripping at clods of grass and ruminating. And it was, you know, great end-of-the-day scene. Then he has his chickens. He waits 3 days exactly, and then he tows them into that paddock that was vacated by the cows. The reason he waits 3 days is very interesting. But anyway, once he gets in there, he calls it his henmobile, and it looks like a kind of ramshackle prairie schooner. He's made it himself. It's not an elegant piece of technology. And he lowers the gangplanks, and 300 laying hens come streaming down the gangplanks, and they fan out over the paddock and the pasture. And what they do is they go right for the cow patties. And what they want to do is eat the larvae, the maggots, out of the cow patties. And the reason he's waited 3 days is to grow those maggots as big and juicy as he can. But if he waited any longer, on the fifth day, they would hatch, and he'd have flies everywhere. So he, by understanding the life cycle of this parasite, he's able to grow the important protein source for his chickens. And so what they do is they eat all the flies. They take care of his fly problem. He calls the hens his sanitation crew. And then they do other things, though. In the process of digging out these larvae, they spread his manure so he doesn't have these clumps. And they fertilize the paddock with their own very high, very rich nitrogen manure themselves. And then he knows exactly how long they can be there before the nitrogen load is too high, and then he moves them to the next paddock. And then 6 weeks later, boom, he has this flush, this grass in the blaze of growth, and he can either cut it for hay or he can bring in the cows again. And it's a really exciting relationship because it's based on the relationship of birds and ruminants in nature. Birds are always following ruminants, cleaning up after them. But to really appreciate it, we just have to bear down and look at what, remember I said he was a grass farmer, the grass plant itself. And so just think for a minute about one of those grass plants in one of those paddocks. What's happening is that when a grass plant is sheared by a ruminant, it does something very interesting. It wants to keep its root mass in rough balance with its leaf mass so that if it loses its leaf mass, it's called the root-shoot ratio. You gardeners will be familiar with that term. So what it does is it sheds roots to balance out. When it sheds the roots, it kind of cauterizes them and they die. And then they are set upon by all the life living in the soil, the earthworms, the protozoa, the bacteria, the viruses, the fungi, and they digest those roots. And when they're done digesting it, that is soil, compost. And that's how soil is built. Soil is built from the bottom up. This is how the great topsoil of the prairies was built. That pulsing of the pasture. So he's actually creating soil. And what does that mean? Well, what that means is, at the end of the year, and I'll tell you how much food he takes off this 100 acres, 40,000 pounds of beef, 30,000 pounds of pork, 10,000 broilers, 1,200 turkeys, 1,000 rabbits, 35,000 dozen eggs off of this 100 acres. And you know what? At the end of the year, there is more biodiversity, not less. There is more fertility, not less. There is more soil, not less. The significance of that is, this is not a zero-sum system. In our heads, I think all of us are stuck in this idea that for us to get what we want from nature, nature must be diminished. It is a process of subtraction. He is suggesting it need not be that way. A truly sustainable system can actually improve the soil, improve biodiversity, leave the land better than before we removed our food from it. Now, there's one example. There are other people doing this. As I said, as heartening as anything I've seen, because it makes you question that basic framework that we're in this tragic zero-sum relationship with the natural world. Well, maybe we need not be. And that is really, I think, the goal, the ultimate goal of a sustainable agriculture.
On New World Notes, we're hearing Michael Pollan on the future of food. Our conventional industrial agriculture cannot continue, and our organic industrial agriculture is not much better. Polyface Farms is a better model of how to do organic right. Now Pollan goes on to explain, in general, why smaller, relocalized farming is what we need. Why your local farmer's market beats the supermarket every time. And what about New England? Unlike California, here we can't buy fresh local produce 12 months a year. We have this oddball local tradition that we call winter. But Pollan is a lapsed New Englander himself, and he has a solution for winter, too. Here again is Michael Pollan.
One of the things about Joel that's very important is he only sells locally. He would not put that in the mail, mail for me. And I want to say a few words before I take some questions in favor of local food economies. You know, we're told today that it's sentimental. We're told it's reactionary to go back to local food, small farms, that kind of agriculture, and that the future is a globalized food economy where we get our milk powder from New Zealand and our organic food from China, and everything is produced wherever it can be produced most cheaply and shipped to wherever it can be sold most dearly. This is the dream of the globalizers. We should be putting our land, our people, to a higher use than agriculture, as if there were any such thing. And that to fight this is a rearguard action, is nostalgia. Now, there are reasons in support of local food, and you know them, that might strike the unsentimental as soft-headed. Let's try out a few. Well, we really like the idea of keeping farmers and their wisdom in our communities. We like the idea of keeping land near us in production, in food, rather than in houses and strip malls. We want to defend the land that we love. We like the idea of eating food in season, picked at the peak of its taste and nutritional value. We like what happens socially at the farmer's market, which is really emerging as the new public square in many of our towns, and I know that's true here. Here's a wonderful arena where city meets country, where people politic and, you know, pass out petitions and schmooze. Compare that to what happens in your supermarket. In fact, somebody did a study and they found that you have 10 times as many conversations at the farmer's market than you do at the supermarket. And I don't think we need a sociologist to tell us that, but it is true. And I think we like, and again, another sentimental reason, how the farmer's market or CSA lets us reconnect through these plants and animals and farmers to the natural world. I mean, think of what our children learn there. They learn that a carrot is not a glossy orange bullet that comes in a plastic bag, but is actually a root. This was news to my son. I'm fully prepared to defend local food on those sentimental grounds, because I actually think they're very important. And I would point out that these relationships that I'm describing are a set of non-zero-sum relationships. This is about a lot more than the exchange of money for food. But let me move the argument onto another ground, on a hard-headed, unsentimental ground for a second. Let me suggest that it is the globalizers of food, the free traders of food, who are the real sentimentalists. And Wendell Berry has made this point brilliantly in a piece called The Total Economy. It is they who are acting on a faith for which there is no justification. Not unlike the Soviet communists, he wrote, who are the last great destroyers of local food economies, they tell us we need to sacrifice things we like here and now, landscapes, relationships, local enterprises, downtowns, for the promise of future prosperity that globalization will bring. We must, as Lenin said, break a few eggs to make an omelet. But tell me, what could be more unrealistic, more soft-headed, than to propose we should destroy things that we love, that we have now, that we treasure in the present, for the uncertain promise of some future benefit, of cheaper food? Let us stick with the eggs. Let us keep them from cracking. Let me suggest that there is nothing more hard-headed or realistic than building and defending local food economies. Indeed, to do so is not a matter of sentiment, but of critical importance to national security and public health. Let me explain what I mean. Energy. This global food economy, this promise of growing it wherever you can and moving it wherever it will be paid for, is going to depend on cheap energy. It does already. Not to mention international peace and security from terrorism. We will not reduce our dependence on foreign sources of energy or confront the issue of climate change without dealing with an industrialized, globalized food economy, without cutting some of the energy out of that system. Sovereignty. Do we really want to lose control of our food system and our destiny around food the way we have lost control of our destiny around oil? I don't think people want to go there if they were to think about it at all. But make no mistake, to find ourselves dependent on foreign sources of food is precisely where the globalizers want to take us. National security. Well, our government knows better than we eaters the risks of a highly centralized food system. There was a very interesting moment post 9/11 where people looked at the food system for just a second and then closed that door. Tommy Thompson, when he retired from Health and Human Services, he was asked what had surprised him. He said, "For the life of me, I cannot understand why the terrorists have not attacked our food supply, because it is so easy to do." The reason it would be so easy to do was laid out in he was responding to this 2003 GAO study that found that our food system, because it is so highly centralized, is subject to both deliberate and accidental contamination. So what is the government doing to deal with this threat? Well, absolutely nothing. You would think a country genuinely concerned about the security of its food system, the first thing they would do is decentralize it. And we're doing nothing in that direction. I mean, we as consumers are, but as a government, we're not doing anything. Public health. And as I said, we've just had an example of how precarious a highly centralized food system can be. It's not to say you don't have problems in a local food system. You can have E. coli in the spinach in your farmer's market, too. But when that happens, it will not be a national story. It will not affect thousands of people. It will not close down spinach across the country. Although it's kind of interesting to see that spinach was not closed down in the farmer's market. At least in my market in Berkeley, spinach was still doing quite brisk sales. Why? Well, because people there put their faith not in regulations or what the FDA tells them, but in relationships, not technology. And I think this is all these reasons are why we're seeing local food economies booming right now. So, yes, when the government won't protect our land, our communities, our economies, our local economies, we have to do it ourselves as consumers, citizens. And we will. We can build a local food economy simply by getting out of the supermarket and voting with our forks. And we can do it very easily in this area, much more easily here than in many parts of the country. To do so, though, we're talking about a new kind of consumer. You know, another word that needs some rectification. You know, it's a really ugly word. It's even uglier than sustainable, I think. I've always hated that identity, you know, to be treated by the marketplace as a consumer. It conjures this selfish creature prowling the aisles looking for good deals. You know, someone who's diminishing, you know, consuming, diminishing the world by his or her decision, subtracting from it. But imagine a different concept of the consumer, one that incorporates the values of the citizen and even the species, in which the shopper recognizes his or her obligations to a commonwealth, as a citizen does, and even to a biotic community, as Aldo Leopold said. You know, we can shop for value in that debased McDonald's term of the value meal, or we can shop for values, our values. We can redefine the consumer as a creator of new food chains. It's true, to do this takes more work, and we can talk about it later, shopping, foraging for food, cooking again, because you will not find anything microwavable at the farmer's market. And it's more expensive. That's a very important part of the dilemma we're in. When you pay the real sustainable cost of your food, it will be more expensive. And we need to spend more money on food. True, not everybody can, but many of us can. Most of the people in this room can. We're spending less than 10% of our income on food. That is less than any people in the history of the planet. Any people anywhere on Earth. 10%. Less than. When I was a kid, it was 18%. It's fallen. Where's all that money going? Well, you know, think what we weren't buying back then. Cell phones. We didn't pay for television in 1960. You know, entertainment is sucking up a lot of that money. We will have to elevate the importance of food in our lives and in our culture to make us feel good about spending more than we need to on food. We need a new consumer who really understands what Wendell Berry famously said, that eating is an agricultural act. It's an ecological and political act as well. We have a precious vote here, our food dollars. In fact, we have three of them a day. And if you think about it, how many other areas of your life can you make such an affirmative vote? We have more control over this than so much in our lives. And to not use that vote well. Not every time. People aren't going to vote right for food every single time. But even if you do it once a day, and one economist said if people would just spend $10 a week on local foods, it would be a revolution. We can help create the world we want to live in, one delicious bite at a time. Now, before I finish, I want to make one other point, because we can vote with our forks, and that is very important, but we also need to vote with our votes. And I just want to say a real quick word about the Farm Bill. So much of the system I've been describing, so much of the industrial food system, is the result not of nature, not of the free market, but of a set of policies that are enshrined in this bill, erroneously called the Farm Bill. It's boring, it's obscure, it's complicated. I'm not going to go into it tonight, but attention must be paid. These are the rules of the game, and they get reset every 5 or 7 years, and they're getting reset this year, or next year, 2007. These rules determine what sort of agriculture your tax dollars will support. Corn and soybeans or local vegetables, feedlot meat or local animal production. You have to let your senators and representatives know you're paying attention so they won't trade their votes anymore, because that's essentially what they're doing outside of the farm states. Don't even let them call it a farm bill. It's a food bill, and it's your fight. Thank you very much.
I'd just like to follow up on your last point about local food systems. And the question I have is that, as you say, it's easier to do here than other places, that community-supported agriculture and farmers' markets and so on often have to shut down half the year in areas where it's not feasible to grow things year-round. So how do we deal with that dilemma, that it is obviously better for people to eat fresh foods most of the time, nutritionally it's better, and yet, in many parts of the country, that's going to involve transportation. So I'm just curious, you know, how do you solve that solution of local food, but also nutritious fresh food in areas where it's not possible to do that?
Well, I think that you're absolutely right. You know, I'm from New England, and I tried very hard to eat locally there, and there is a lot you can do for half the year. You do have a meat economy. I mean, the rhythm of meat in the East Coast is very different than here, because you slaughter animals in the fall, in the late fall, and so you do have a lot of meat over the winter, because the grass is very green in the fall. So that becomes an important part of the winter diet. And there will be some shipment of food. There's no question. There will still be. Before California started producing the nation's produce, people ate frozen food in the winter, frozen produce, which I actually think is kind of overlooked as a food source. It's often more nutritious than food that's spent, 5 days on a truck. So, it's not going to be all the time, and there's still going to be trade in food. And these are, I think we have to be realistic. But I think it goes back to that point that, you're not going to cast every vote exactly right. But to use the fact that it's difficult or can't happen all the time to say, well, this isn't practical, I think is a mistake too. I think if we were to eat locally when we could eat locally, that in itself would represent a profound change in the food system. It was only 50 or 60 years ago that New York was fed by New Jersey, called the Garden State. Because that's where New York City got its food. It didn't get its food from California, not very much of it. A lot of that farmland is still there, actually. So I think there's more that can be done in the northern tier than is. I also think that, this is going to sound funny, but this idea you have to have a fresh salad every day, all year round. Salad is a really overrated food in many ways. There are other things to have in the winter. I did some calculations, and bringing an organic salad across the country, one of those pre-washed mesclun salads, 56 calories of fossil fuel for every calorie of food energy. There's very little food energy in a salad. So if you were to make a salad out of cabbage or root vegetables, you would probably, from a nutritional point of view, do quite well. So, I'm not going to sit here and write a cookbook about the wonders of root vegetables, although I do think we'll need to rediscover them if we go really local.
Michael Pollan, explaining why the idealistic nutcases are not your hippie organic farmers, but rather Archer Daniels Midland and other agribusiness giants. Your local farmer is the sane one, and the sane thing for us to do is buy his crops. And why not grow some food ourselves in a garden? In the meantime, you'll find this installment of our show and hundreds of others, plus pretty pictures and whatnot, on our website, newworldnotes.blogspot.com. And thank you for listening. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, advising illegitimi non-carborundum, support your local farmer, death to Twinkies, bottled water, and canned peas, and above all, eat your broccoli. Ciao.